Taking a look at bats here in Wisconsin and elsewhere and how we can protect them. Larry Mueller here. My guest today, Dave Riddell, is a conservation biologist and state bat specialist in the DNR's Endangered Resources Program, and he monitors routinely the colonies of nearly 150,000 bats. He's been at the forefront of state and national efforts to understand and develop response plans addressing something that they call white nose syndrome. And I should also mention that Dave and his wife, Lisa Wilson, have established an endowment to provide for long-term protection of bats in Wisconsin. I'm certainly going to ask him about that, too, as we move along today. But great to have him here. Great to have you listening. Give us a call with your questions at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. And Dave Riddell, welcome. Thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Larry.
Why should we care about bats?
Number of reasons. I think, for one, they're amazing creatures just in their own right. But in terms of how they benefit humans, we can look at just their ecological role on the landscape. With a lot of times we understand their role in agricultural pests, forest pests, as well as pests that carry human disease, such as mosquitoes for West Nile virus.
They're pollinators, if I'm not mistaken, aren't they?
Worldwide, there's a role for just about everything. Here in Wisconsin, they're all insectivorous, so all voracious insect eaters here.
Yeah, and they eat a lot of mosquitoes.
Yes, that's usually what most people like to hear.
that's a really good thing. Well, we have, what, 7 species here in the state?
Yes, that's what we've got here, and the 8th would be the Indiana bat, which hasn't been seen here since the 1950s.
Wow. And the most common? Which is the most common?
Our role here in Wisconsin for large numbers of bats is the little brown bat.
Yeah, and is it the little brown bat, or are all bats affected with this white nose syndrome? And maybe you can talk about what that syndrome is and, you know.
Sure. Well, not all of our bats are affected. There's 2 different groups of bats. We've got migratory tree bats that don't use hibernation sites. They migrate south. That's 3 species. It's the 4 cave bat species that are affected by this white nose syndrome. Back up a little bit. What is white nose syndrome?
Yeah.
It's a recently found in New York back in 2006, 2007, a strange white powdery substance found on the muzzles of the bats, giving it its name, and on the wing membranes, some white powdery substance. They recently found out it's actually a fungus, and not described by science until last year. And it's basically spreading rapidly and having extremely high mortality rates on our cave bat species. You know, when we've got hibernation sites, bats are collecting from across the landscape, sort of on all your eggs in one basket.
Yeah.
Type situation, and it's been wiping out nearly 70 to 95 or even 100% of the bats in these hibernating colonies.
And we're talking of some pretty good-sized colonies then, too.
Yes. A lot of these sites, at least out in the Northeast, they had some large numbers of bats. There's only a limited number of places these bats can hibernate because caves and mines are only so
yeah,
many places.
Only so many of them, sure.
So that's been a devastating effect.
And I want to ask you a little bit about how much we know about this this white nose syndrome in terms of, I mean, treating it. It's got to be a real difficult issue.
Yes, for a number of reasons. One, the timeline we're working on, it's moving so rapidly. Ahead of the research. But there's been a number of good research experiments looking at different treatment options. And we also have to be careful that we're not going in heavy-footed to, say, a cave ecosystem that has a variety of other endangered species and treat the entire cave for a fungus when we may be killing something else. So we have to be very careful.
So there are other endangered species that inhabit those caves.
Yes. A lot of caves support species found only in that one cave.
Oh, boy. Okay, so there are lots of things to consider. I know we have quite a few people who have questions for you, Dave, and I'm tempted to turn to the phones here. In fact, let's just do that. Tammy in Madison, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi. I have a couple questions for Dave specifically about the bat exclusions at Merivale and at Ledgeview Caves. As far as the bat exclusions go, I understand that they have not been successful and that there are still bats that are entering those caves. The other concern that I have is that, you know, as far as the ecological role of bats, the bats provide guano for the systems, which is an energy input into the systems. So, I mean, there's nobody out there, I think, that doesn't want to save bats. But I think that this exclusion of bats is going to exclude energy into the system, and then it's also going to be detrimental to other species that rely on the guano and live on the guano that's in the caves. I particularly have worked on a number of species that actually rely on this energy input, and I've participated in a number of studies. And I just, I'm just very, very concerned that with this exclusion of bats that you're, you know, cutting off your nose to spite your face. And the other thing is the other question I have regarding these bats. I understand right now that they've been excluded, they've been removed, and that they are now currently residing in a cooler in Madison. And I just don't think that that's the best place for a bat, especially if these are now endangered or endangered species. Thanks.
All right. Thanks for calling, Tammy. Well, he's quite a bit to chew on there.
Yeah, let me try and address these in order if I can remember. The Merivale, well, yeah, let's talk about the guano input. That's certainly true. These are complex systems, and a lot of these cave systems rely on a variety of nutrient inputs, including bat guano. I think looking at Merivale and Ledgeview in particular, we're talking about two cave systems that are relatively small numbers of bats. We're not talking about a population impact for these two systems. We have to look at risk minimization as a whole, and stopping or slowing white nose syndrome from entering these caves is our best option for right now to, I guess you could say, have guano input in the future. If we lose the bats, we won't have that at all. Let me try and think which...
Something about, and I kind of missed a part of it, but about some bats in a cooler, or...
Right. Well, we've had some of the bats. The exclusion of bats from a cave is not easy, as you can imagine. There's a lot of small cracks and places for bats to still get in or out. It's a learning experience and something we're working on with our partners at both sites. And one site, during exclusion, we were able to release the bats there on site in order to find, you know, it was early enough in the fall migration season that they were at the point where they can go to alternative sites. So if it gets too late in the year, we want to make sure we're not excluding the bats to a death sentence, and they can be released later in the year.
Okay, and that's why they're in the coolers.
Right. Well, it's a little more complicated than
a little more complicated, but that's basically the reason to save them for another year.
Yes.
Wayne and Holcomb, will we turn to you next? Hi, Wayne.
Hello.
What's on your mind?
Well, I had a little experience with some dead bats at my place up on the north end of Lake Holcomb.
Yes.
And that's north of Eau Claire, about 60 miles or so.
Right. I know right where it is.
Yeah. I have an outbuilding that's a garage and what I use for an office. And in about 3 weeks' period of time, I've counted 28 dead bats, all right very close to this shed out there. I called the health department, the DNR. After about a week and a half or 2 weeks, a person came down from the health department and took two bats. I had taken a fresh one, put it in a bag, and put it in the fridge. and I'd taken another fresh one and froze it. So I thought I'd have a two-fisted solution to
sure.
check out these bats. Well, he came down, got it, sent it to Madison, and it came back. There was nothing wrong with these bats. They didn't have any strange-looking fungus on them or anything. But 28 bats in less than 3 weeks.
Yeah.
And it seemed like the problem disappeared. No one from the DNR, no one from anywhere came out just to even check the place out to see what might be killing the bats.
Well, that's thank you very much for bringing that up. And that one of the things we've been planning on is to get this information from folks like you. I'm guessing you probably found this in the month of July or August. Is that correct?
It would have been probably closer to July or maybe even late June, middle to late June.
Okay.
And I actually I called several people, DNR, and I got the number of a biologist who is residing in La Crosse.
Mm-hmm.
Left two messages there, never got a call back.
Yeah.
Well, we've got a online reporting system for things. We're monitoring the health of bats. Obviously, we're more keyed into it right now with white nose syndrome. We wouldn't expect to see any fungus on them in the summer. It's a cold-loving fungus in wet conditions that we're only going to see displayed underground during the winter. But occasionally, I mean, 28 is a large number of bats to die. It's probably a maternity colony, like you said, in your shed. And they, you know, we occasionally get young of the year that drop. We've had some high heat temperatures that cause bats to die. And it's typically in that
July, August.
Yeah, July, August. So if other listeners find similar situations, even five bats we're interested in, and there's an online reporting system you can find through the Wisconsin Bat Monitoring Program, it'll send an email to me and the Wildlife Health staff and gives you information on what to do for collection.
So so if you go to your search engine and type in Wisconsin Bat Monitoring Program?
Yes, that'll get you to an online form.
Okay, Wisconsin Bat Monitoring Program. Wayne, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Dave Riddell, our guest today, as we talk about protecting bats in Wisconsin and elsewhere across the country. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll go back to the phones and take your questions as we talk with Dave Riddell of the DNR. He's a conservation biologist and our state bat specialist in the DNR's Bureau of Endangered Resources. Let's turn to John in Decorah, Iowa next. John, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Hey, I was curious with in the last couple of decades, all the genetically modified organisms and, you know, ever-expanding monoculture fields and all the pesticides and herbicides and fungicides we spray, if you have studied or know if that's leading to any of these problems or if it's contributing to any of the problems.
Good question. I am certainly not an expert on that topic, and I wouldn't know. I could only speculate rather than give you an honest answer. But I know there are some... They've looked at white nose syndrome related to pesticide use out east, and there hasn't been any strong links right now to suspect that's actually the problem.
That's causing the problem. Okay, there you go. Steve in Cornell, we go to you now. Hi, Steve.
Hello. I love the program. Thank you. I'm just curious, how far north, I am out of Cornell, and Lane was out of Holcomb there, previous caller.
Yeah.
I'm very curious how far north the white-nose syndrome has traveled.
Yeah.
Okay. Since its introduction into the United States, it has spread through 14 states. Basically up from the East Coast down to Tennessee, over to Missouri, and that's about 225 miles from our southern border. It has since gone through Quebec and Ontario and Canada, and the furthest, the closest north to us is the Ontario site just above the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. And that's about 300 miles to our north, so not too far from you.
Okay. With a question of preventative medicine, is there anything that's preventative for the bat houses? There's small population bat houses in the area. Is there anything that we could do to prevent spread of that white nose disease?
Nothing known at this time, and I don't know that that's a priority for study right now in the summer locations. Right now we're looking at treatment options in the hibernacula where they're most affected. Mm-hmm. But the best you can do is maintain your summer roost bat house and help us monitor it and help mm-hmm. us watch the health of the population.
So do you keep,
thank you.
All right, thanks very much for calling. So you're certainly not you certainly want people to have those bat houses up. And
absolutely.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Marilyn in South Range, on to you. Hi, Marilyn.
Hi. Well, I'm terribly interested in attracting bats to our rural Wisconsin home way up here in the northern country where we can see Lake Superior, you know, 15 miles away. And so, therefore, I have a couple questions. To put up bat houses, do they overwinter in those bat houses? Or is it a certain type of bat that would maybe inhabit it during the summertime only, or
yeah.
what?
Yeah, these bat houses are pretty much summer only. Primarily what you're going to want to do is attract a maternity colony, which is the female, so you can get a large number in there, and those females will raise their young. Come fall, they're going to, it's not suitable for hibernation. That's going to get below freezing, and the bats won't be able to survive. So they will head to hibernacula, either a cave or mine, to spend the winter.
So they have up here in the north country caves that I don't know about, but they
know about
over winter.
Yes, and they can travel quite far to get there, a couple hundred miles to get to their winter sites.
Right. One other comment. We went down to Arkansas to an absolutely beautiful cave called Blanchard Springs, and we're able to, cavern, I think it is, or something, and we're able to go into the cavern, but before we went in, everybody was required to take off certain things. You couldn't bring in cameras, you couldn't bring on, you wouldn't have a belt on, and if you had shoes, you had to put your shoes into a cleaning solution. Now, I suppose they don't really know what's going to prevent it, and it's probably preventative, but I sure would not want to live in this country without bats. And yeah. So what do you think of that method, or have mm-hmm. you heard of it?
Well, I assume you're talking about a recent process for Arkansas. There's a number of reasons why they may be wanting to keep people clean going into a system, not just for the everyday things you bring in, but if it's white nose related, we want to minimize risk of human transmission. If we bring, say, a fungus in on our clothing that's been at an affected site, we don't want to spread it to this new clean site, and that can actually increase the number of sites that are affected and then transfer it to the bats.
Yeah, there you go.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much for calling. Ethan in Madison, we're on to you now. Hi, Ethan.
Hi, Dave. I just got a quick question. It sounds like a major part of the DNR's proposal is to exclude bats from any place that humans might visit and to exclude humans from visiting any place where bats might exist. So it sounds like you're targeting transmission by humans. This seems a little bit strange to me since most of the research points to bat-to-bat transmission. Hasn't the Fish and Wildlife Service said that white nose syndrome is transmitted primarily from bat-to-bat? I'm just wondering whether excluding humans will do any good, whether excluding bats will just end up killing the bats to save them, and I'm just concerned that the rush to respond to this has prevented a good evaluation of the best way to respond and not given time for experts and people who have been researching this for 2 or 3 years now to give their input.
Yeah, well, thank you for the question. I think it's more of a broad generalization you put in there with excluding bats from sites versus humans. We're looking at a small number of sites that are higher risk than others. with very small bat populations. Generally, the non-visited sites are very rarely visited sites. We've had a lot of good cooperation from our landowners that are interested in protecting bats and aren't necessarily interested in excluding bats. As far as your discussion about research on human transmission, right now, yes, the Fish and Wildlife says, and I think the general consensus is, it's primarily bat-to-bat transmission, but there's enough evidence that indicates human transmission is not only possible but likely. And that's where we can get some of these large jump sites. You know, the bats can only fly so far, but a human can transfer it hundreds of miles. And in terms of risk minimization right now, we can't necessarily control where the bats are flying, but at least we can get some help from people that may transport it.
Okay, there you go. Thank you, Ethan. Jason in Stevens Point, hello to you.
Not too bad. Yourself?
Fine. Thanks for calling. What can we do for you?
Hey, I've got a question in regards to some of the proposals that DNR has put forward toward landowners of caves and mine systems in regards to, I guess, bat gates. I'm an active explorer of dry and submerged mines and caves in the Midwestern region, and a lot of the landowners that we've worked with to gain access to their systems have expressed concerns to us that they've been approached by the DNR and told that they're going to have to install gating systems to prevent bats from entering their cave systems. And the DNR is, they've received, I guess, different stories as to whether they're going to be the ones responsible for payment of the system or for the installation of the system. The DNR is going to fund it, or there's going to be a partnership in between the landowner and the state. We haven't really seen anything budgeted from a state perspective for these gates or anything like that. So we're just kind of wondering what, I guess, the official story is with these gates.
Yes. In terms of bat gates, that's, for people that don't know, it's a gate that allows bats access to and from a site with reducing human liability by keeping out unwanted or unauthorized human entry. As far as did the DNR tell people this is what they need to do? No, we have not been telling people you're going to install a bat gate. What we're approaching the landowners with options and voluntary agreements that what do they want to do? What is their interest in the site? And working with them on that behalf, it's certainly not something we're expecting. You know, let's say they do choose to do a bat gate, it's not something we would expect the landowner to purchase. That's something the department could either partnership with the landowner or cover the cost.
Okay, there you go. Thank you very much for your call. You can join in, too, with your questions as we talk about bats and protecting bats here in Wisconsin with Dave Riddell of the DNR, Mike in Columbia County next, but you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. And let's turn to Mike now. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, thanks, Larry. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I have an east wall of my house. I've got a deck along the whole wall, and the deck boards are 2x12 treated lumber, and they're set out from the wall about an inch or so with spacers. And I think that there's bats roosting in there because this summer it looked like there was feces falling, kind of a light brown colored, about the size of a pencil eraser. And I don't know, how do I get those bats not to nest in there? Is that what's in there? And are they gone for the winter? If I wanted to do something, I don't want to seal it up totally because of, you know, I don't want to get moisture sealed in that area. And so if the guest can give me any suggestion, if he thinks those are bats roosting in there, an inch to inch and a half spacing, can they get in there?
Oh, yeah.
Describing perfect bat habitat there. Yeah. On your eastern wall, you get some nice morning heat. That's what they're looking for. I can't say for sure if that's what you've got in there. Your description of the guano being a pencil-sized eraser sounds a little bit thick. It's more of a mouse, I guess I don't have the...
Dropping?
Yeah, mouse dropping would be more in line, elongated. But that sounds like perfect bat roost. The thing you can do, I guess, if you don't want them there, they're out on your deck, you don't want them there, you can put up sort of an exclusion device that lets them out but not back in. So that safely removes the bats without killing them. And again, you can find that information of how to do it yourself on our Wisconsin Bat Monitoring Program website. And I believe it's also on our DNR website. If you go to dnr.wi.gov and search bats, you should be able to find our publication on how to do that safely.
Yeah, you know, they can get through a hole about the size of a dime, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah,
about
very
three
small.
Quarters of an inch or so.
Yeah, and that's how we build bat houses, is three quarters of an inch spacing. But the good thing is they won't chew their way in. They're not rodents, and you don't have to worry about that.
So get those bat excluders, and what's again the name of the site,
Bat Monitoring Program.
Wisconsin Bat Monitoring Program. There you go. Thank you, Mike. And someone emailed and wondered if a bat is captured and released elsewhere, will it simply return to the place where it was captured?
Yeah, that's they've done some really interesting homing experiments back in usually the late 60s and early 70s is when they were doing that. They found some bats taken as far as 100, 200 miles away were able to find their way back. One interesting story I heard was a study where they took bats from a site, I believe over 100 miles, released them, drove back to the site, and the bats had beaten them.
Back?
Yeah.
Well, given that, then excluding bats from particular caves is... I guess if they come back and they can't get in, then they'll go elsewhere?
Yeah, well, the fall swarming is mating season, and bats typically visit different hibernation sites. So if they can't find a way into one suitable site...
they'll go to another.
The hope is they'll go to their other site that's a suitable alternative.
And Richard in Hartford has a question for you, so let's go to Richard. Hi, Richard.
Good morning. How are you?
Good.
Back in the late 80s, I drove a limousine, and some of the businesses would use us here in the Milwaukee area. And one particular businessman was from Austin, Texas. Mm-hmm. And I've never been to Austin, so I asked him, I said, how's Austin? What's good about Austin? He says, well, he says, I'll tell you what. He says, we got a million bats. And at that time, I thought, well, I think this guy might be exaggerating a little. So about 5 years later, my daughter moved to Austin for a job that she had. And my wife and I drove down there, which is a beautiful city, Austin. And I told my daughter, I said, hey, where are these bats at? So she took us over to the freeway underpass, one of their freeway underpasses. And as the sun was setting, and it was getting a little dark, the bats flew out of there, and it was like a bomb coming out from under this freeway, and the sky really turned dark. I believe the man, there was a million bats. And a question that I have, other than I know the temperature, the weather in Austin is normally beautiful, what would attract that many bats? I'm just looking at one underpass. I'm assuming there's many, many more.
There are.
And what would attract the bats there that wouldn't attract them, say, to our structures here in the Milwaukee or your Madison area?
Right. Well, that's the one you're talking about is the Congress Avenue Bridge. I've been there. It is spectacular. It's a maternity colony of, say, 750,000 females, which then reproduces into 1.5 million bats. And as you say, when they come out of that bridge, it's an amazing sight. It's over the river. And why are they all there? It's Mexican free-tailed bats. And in Texas, on radar, they've actually picked up insect migrations coming in from Mexico. And these bats will fly up and up to as far as 10,000 feet in the air and intercept these agricultural pests, providing quite the service. why don't we have that here in Wisconsin? That species itself is typically found in very large colonies. We do know that we've got bats in our bridges, not to that extent. But if you certainly find any, let us know.
All right, thanks for calling. Before we go back to the phones, I want to go to the talk about the endowment that you and your wife have established to provide for long-term protection of bats. Tell us what prompted you to do this and talk about it.
Yeah, it's set up through the Natural Resources Foundation of Wisconsin. They create an endowment that provides funding in perpetuity rather than a single project at a time. We can actually set up a long-term fund. And what prompted us to do that is there really is not a lot of non-game funding. Typically, hunting licenses and things such as that pay for the game species. Finding funds for non-game species such as bats is difficult, and if we can set up something like that for the long term, that's something
you want to really do.
Yes.
And if people want to learn some more about that endowment, where did they go?
I would go to Natural Resources Foundation of Wisconsin website. Just type that into your search engine, and they'll let you know exactly how to provide a tax-deductible donation.
So the Natural Resources Foundation of Wisconsin, that's the place to
Correct.
Go. Correct. Okay. Very good. Let's go to Jim in Eau Claire next. Jim, hello.
Hello. How are you this morning?
Great.
I don't have a particular question. I just wanted to make a comment about a couple of items that have caught my interest recently. A book that we got through WPR, it's called Bats Sing, Mice Giggle.
Yeah.
And it's an interesting book, The Surprising Science of Animals' Inner Life. An intriguing reading, written for a layman, and I've enjoyed it so very, very much. And one other comment, because of our new interest in the royals in England, they were commenting about some of the idiosyncrasies. They have bats in one of their castles in northern Scotland, and they asked, well, what do they do with them? They said the queen has a very long pole with a net on it, and she captures them, and then she has to release them because it's illegal to kill bats in the UK. So bats are showing up everywhere.
Oh, they are pretty much everywhere, aren't they, Dave?
Yeah, worldwide, they're one of the most diverse groups of mammals out there. But as you said, in the UK, they're highly protected. They've got they get excited if they've got a hibernating colony of 50 bats, whereas here in Wisconsin, we may have one site with 150,000. So we certainly hope to maintain that here. At least if white-nose syndrome comes through, we want to maintain as many as we can for a recovery population and not end up in the Scotland Castle situation.
Thanks, Jim, for calling. Mike in Racine, let's go to you now. Hi, Mike.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question about what's a good way to promote bats in urban areas? I've had a bat house up at my house for several years now with no results. I'm wondering what I can do to have some come visit me.
Well, as it's always in real estate, it's location, mm-hmm. location, location, and the design of the bat house. Best way to encourage them, you can't necessarily attract them to your site, but the best way to encourage them to take up residence, and might add that urban areas do just well with, say, big brown bats, or depending on how close you are to water, little brown bats. If you can put them up, get them nice and warm. Put them up 10 feet in the air, east, south, or west facing direction with some good sunlight, 6-7 hours a day. Heat that house up, and the females will definitely like it. The best you can do is provide a nice bat house large enough that is suitable in terms of temperature.
And there are some... I think Extension even has a publication on building your own bat house.
Yes, Extension Services, as well as that same website. We put one out on At least I'm pretty sure we've got that out now. I've got I'm not sure if it's in draft form or not, but it's certainly ready to go. Check our website or the DNR's website.
Okay. And again, that other website you mentioned was?
Wisconsin Bat Monitoring Program.
Wisconsin Bat Monitoring Program. That's the place to go. Mike, thank you for calling. Good luck with that bat house. And Ethan and Madison, your turn. Hi.
Hey, it seems like the DNR has taken a much more aggressive strategy here than any other state or a federal wildlife group management group is doing. I'm just wondering, where did the policy come from? Did you guys develop it entirely in-house? Was it based on recommendations from outside experts, peer-reviewed scientific literature? I'm also wondering that since the proposal has been made public, have you received any input on it from outside experts? I heard that Hazel Barton, a microbiology professor who studies cave environments, was up at the DNR meeting, which unfortunately I couldn't come to, a couple weeks ago. What did she have to say about the proposal?
Okay.
Well, which policy are you talking about?
The putting the bats as a threatened species, the exclusions.
Okay. Well, yeah, actually, that's great timing for that comment, because right now we are in the public comment period. And folks that have an interest in getting involved can provide comment on these three specific rules, as you mentioned, listing the bats as threatened, as well as the fungus as a prohibited invasive species, as well as some decontamination mm-hmm. protocols and implementation measures. As far as where did we come up with this, we've been involved from the very beginning at the national level, dealing with other state bat biologists. We've got a long-standing discussions with federal and state agencies on some different measures. If you look back in the timeline, out east they really didn't have time to plan. There was no planning effort there. Yeah. They were basically documenting mass mortalities. And as we move forward at the national level, we have to start looking at what can we do to slow the spread. And one of these things that we can do is discuss these different options with the bat community, conservation community, outside experts, and I go from there. So it's a changing environment based on the speed of spread, and we're now... Actually, the benefit we have here in Wisconsin is we've had a little bit of time to plan.
Excellent. Thank you very much for your question, Ethan. And Dave, thank you so much for being with us today. Tell us once more that website to go to.
Well, I think the first one you should go to is dnr.wi.gov, search for bats. And there's some other bat information for Wisconsin. I think the specific address is wiatri.com/inventory/bats. That's the Wisconsin Bat Monitoring Program.
I'd rather write in Wisconsin Bat Monitoring Program.
Yeah,
yes. We'll remember that one, Wisconsin Bat Monitoring Program. And then for the foundation, for the endowment that you put together for bats, if people just type in the Natural Resources Foundation of Wisconsin, they can find out more about your
yes.
endowment as well. Dave, a great pleasure. Thank you. I hope we can have you back.
Well, thank you for having me.
Dave Riddell is a conservation biologist and state bat specialist in the DNR's Endangered Resources Bureau. And he's the person who's, he's one of several people probably who are monitoring colonies. He monitors nearly 150,000 bats in various colonies, and has been working a lot to try and address this white nose syndrome problem. So great to have him with us today, and we'll keep you in touch. We'll keep you informed on what's happening with our bats and with that white nose syndrome. We have coming up a look at 10 ways to measure Wisconsin seasons you might never have heard of, and we're going to be talking with Dennis Prusik of Green Bay, Wisconsin. He edits the Wisconsin Nature Calendar for Home and Cabin. So looking forward to visiting with him next on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.